Case number 12-1229, American Tort Reform Association Petitioner versus Occupational Safety and Health Administration et al. Mr. Griever for the petitioner, Ms. Phillips for the respondents, Ms. Veldick for the union intervenors.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I've reserved 3 minutes of rebuttal time. In May 2012, OSHA issued final rules amending its longstanding hazard communication standard, or HAZCOM standard, which is OSHA's standard for regulating the potential risks and warning labels for chemicals used in the workplace. OSHA's stated effort in amending that standard was to promote and implement a globally harmonized system and uniform warning labels and uniform communication standards for chemicals in the workplace. And most of the amendments to the hazard communication standard went through an over 5-year notice and comment process involving hundreds of participants from industry, from labor unions, from consumer groups, across the board. There was one amendment, however, that did not go through that notice and comment process, and that was the amendment to the HCS, or the HAZCOM preemption clause. And in that amendment, OSHA essentially undermined the very goal that it stated of creating a nationally uniform system for hazard communication and warning labeling. The amendment has the effect of not promoting but undermining national uniformity by allowing states to impose their own requirements in addition to or different from the requirements set forth in the hazard communication standard. And it does that through the vehicle, it allows states to do that through the vehicle of common law claims and jury verdicts that might impose different requirements separate and apart from or in addition to the hazard communication standard.
But there's never been uniformity with respect to that, has there? I mean, state tort law claims have always been cut out of OSHA, right? Right from the very beginning, there was always this understanding that workman's comp and state tort claims were going to be treated differently.
Well, I would agree with part of that, Your Honor. I think workman's comp clearly was carved out under Section 4 of the OSH Act. And potentially other claims have been carved out as well, but not all claims across the board.
How about GADE? What do you do with GADE? GADE doesn't seem to help you.
Well, actually, Your Honor, we think GADE does help us. What GADE says is that claims that may have a direct, clear, and substantial impact on the area that OSHA is regulating are precluded. Now, GADE only dealt with positive enactments, a local regulatory scheme, I think a licensing scheme in that case. But the reasoning still applies. What Gates said was that the savings clause under the OSH Act, Section 4, does not save claims which otherwise would have a direct, clear, and substantial impact on the area that OSHA is regulating.
But both the plurality opinion and Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion spoke about generally applicable laws and indicated that generally applicable laws didn't fall within the fold of preemption. And wouldn't you consider tort actions of the type that you're concerned about in your brief to be quintessentially generally applicable laws?
Some may be and some may not be. I think the question comes down to whether or not the tort claim, again, has a direct, clear, and substantial impact. A failure to warn claim, for example, could very well have a direct, clear, and substantial impact on the defendant, or in this case, on the regulated entity that has to comply with the OSH Act. And that's the question that Gade asks, is does the, whether it's a regulation or a claim, have a direct, clear, and substantial impact?
What's an example of a tort claim that would not have a direct and a substantial effect?
One example might be a design defect claim. A design defect claim might claim that the way in which the chemical, the allegedly injurious chemical, was packaged was improper. That doesn't deal with the subject of the hazard communication standard. Hazard communication standard only deals with labeling and warnings. A design defect claim would not necessarily go into that, and that would be a claim that could be saved under Section 4.
Doesn't your answer make it clear that even if there is something to your argument, there's no right question?
Your Honor, OSHA raised the rightness question, but we think all they questioned was whether or not a court can evaluate the precise outline of the claims that should and should not be preempted. And we don't necessarily disagree with that. We're not asking the court to define precisely the outline of claims that should and should not be presented or preempted.
What is it in the statute that you think you support to your argument, as best I can understand? What is it in the statute?
In the
statutory provision with respect to preemption?
It's a combination of both Section 18 of the OSH Act and Section 4 of the OSH Act. Section 18 has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to be the preemption provision for the OSH Act, and it says that states cannot regulate through any state law, and I use that word, that phrase in quotes, state law is in quotes from Section 18A. States cannot regulate through state law those areas where OSHA has prescribed a standard. Section 4 is the corollary to that, and that saves those claims and those statutes, both common law claims and statutes. Section 4 is specific, common law claims and statutes that do not impact an area that's regulated under an OSHA Act standard.
And what is it you think from these two statutory provisions positively forecloses some language that has been issued by the agency? I'm just really missing it.
Well, what happens, the former language we think fairly tracked Section 18 and Section 4.
What do you think in the current language is positively foreclosed by the statute? I don't get it.
It's what the agency took out of the current language, Your Honor. What the agency took out was the reference to the broader reference to all state laws, and they sharpened it to only preempt legislative enactments.
Well, what was the basis for the prior iteration, for the broader language? What was the basis for that? Was there anything in the statute that required that reading?
We think the prior language was consistent with the statute, Your
Honor.
Was
it required by the statute?
We think any deviation, the deviation is barred by the statute, or is inconsistent with the statute.
I'm thinking about the original iteration of this. What was there in the broader language that was required by the statute? Nothing was required by the statute, right? It was a matter of interpretation, right?
Well, the agency was not required to make any statement whatsoever.
No, but I mean, the language that they used was not compelled by the statute, and perhaps the language they're using now is not compelled by the statute either, right? Seems to be some room for play here.
Well, Your Honor, we think that the language in the prior version was compelled by the statute and that they followed the statute accordingly. Now, not all courts necessarily interpreted it that way. Some courts did, some courts didn't. But we believe the prior version was compelled by the statute. It was properly worded to be consistent with the wording of the OSH Act in Section 18.
I'm trying to understand what's wrong with the language here. What is the legislative rule that is foreclosed by the statute? I don't see it.
The legislative rule here is OSHA's.
They're the precise words that you think are foreclosed by the statute. Not your construction of those words, but the words.
Your Honor, it's the removal of certain words.
Tell me what it is that's left that is foreclosed by the statute. Read me the words that you say, Your Honor, this is unlawful. They can't do this under the statute. There's no such claim here. It just isn't there. And you know exactly, you had to know this question was coming, so here it is. Where is it? What's the language that is foreclosed? I don't even think there's a rule, for one thing. I don't think it's anything more than interpretation, which is not properly before the court for consideration. But let's play the game that there's a legislative rule. So now tell me, what is the rule that is foreclosed by the law?
Your Honor, it's what the agency did to the rule.
No.
They took out the words.
What's left, the heart of your argument is what is now there is unlawful.
That's right.
All right? Read me the words that are now there. Forget that there was ever anything there before. What's now unlawful about the words that are there and that is ripe for consideration and that is not just an interpretation as opposed to a legislative rule?
This is what's unlawful. What they say is this occupational safety and health standard is intended to address comprehensively the issue of classifying potential hazards of chemicals and communicating information concerning hazards and appropriate protective measures to employ and to preempt any legislative or regulatory enactments of a state, political subdivision of the state pertaining to this subject.
Yeah.
They struck legal requirements.
No. So what? Forget what they struck.
What we're saying is that
you've got to end up with an argument based on what's there and convince us that what's there cannot survive scrutiny under the established statutory provisions.
What's there can't survive scrutiny because it's only a partial preemption. It doesn't describe the complete preemption. And even courts have interpreted, based on this rule,
when a court gets a preemption case, that we will look at that language and somehow feel limited in deciding the preemption question?
I believe we've already seen that happen in the trial court in New Jersey in the Nicastro case. There was a pending litigation where the trial court had earlier issued that the previous version of the preemption standard articulated OSHA's intent that that state law failure to work claims be preempted. As soon as this regulation hit the books without notice and comment, the court reversed itself and said, now we see that OSHA has spoken differently. Now we see that OSHA has articulated its intent to not preempt state law claims. This change has an effect.
But I mean, am I not right that in a number of instances they have issued letters, interpretations, opinions that are perfectly consistent with what you're objecting to now?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they haven't changed anything?
They have only issued one opinion letter dealing with this particular provision, and that was issued in the course of that litigation, actually, for the purposes of basically...
But what I'm saying is where they are now is where they always were.
They've only spoken once on the hazard communication standard preemptive effect, Your Honor, and again, that was in that 2010 opinion letter. However, you're correct. OSHA could continue to speak through opinion letters, through other means, through a preamble. But the problem is when they put it in a rule, they memorialized it in a regulation that has the imprimatur of law that courts will go and follow as a binding requirement.
You don't think that there, if any court found it to be binding, you don't think that would be correct?
I don't.
Right. I mean, because your own brief says that the Supreme Court has made clear that absent specific congressional authority otherwise, agencies can offer only their opinions what they think the preemptive effect of its regulation should be. So under your view, which may well be correct, the extent to which any court found this to be binding would be wrong, and it's just an interpretive rule that sets forth the agency's view, which a court can take into consideration, but is not bound by.
We would certainly take that position that they're wrong, but whether that means the court will
follow. How is this any different than a litigation position taken by OSHA, maybe an amicus brief in a state court action? How is this any different than that? It's no question that it's OSHA's view of the law, but that's not the end of the inquiry, is it?
Your Honor, this court has said when an agency speaks through a regulation that's published in the
CDC. We're not here to review agency views of the law. We're here to review final agency action, right? That's what we're convened to do. We're authorized to do.
We certainly don't disagree with that, Your Honor.
And so how is this final agency action?
This court said in American Mining Congress over 20 years ago that when an agency publishes a regulation, even if it's just stating an opinion, if it's published in the CFR, as this is, it should be treated as a legislative rule, not merely interpretive rule.
How is it a legislative rule if, under your argument, it's just an interpretation? They seem mutually exclusive to me.
It's an interpretation that's taken on legislative characteristics by being published in the CFR.
Publication in the CFR, interpretations can be published in the CFR.
My colleague jumping on that question, that's right. I mean, merely because it's in final rulemaking doesn't mean it's not an interpretation.
It hasn't gone through notice and comment, though, Your Honor, and it should have gone through notice and comment. That's our procedural argument in this case, that it should have gone through notice and comment because it's a legislative rule.
But you don't disagree that if it was an interpretive rule, it didn't need to go through notice and comment?
That is law, but we don't agree that it's an interpretive rule. We believe it's a legislative rule.
And your best argument for why it's a legislative rule is that it's in the CFR?
It's not the only argument, Your Honor. It's a legislative rule because it's binding.
But you don't think it is binding?
It shouldn't be binding, but it's already been proven to be binding in at least one court, and it will continue to be binding as a practical matter. And it's also a substantial change from the announcement in the preamble, in the proposed rule, for where the agency was headed with this.
But
there was no forewarning on this.
That trial court opinion somehow disposes of the issues, do you?
No, we don't think the trial court opinion disposes of the issues.
I mean, it's interesting it happened, but it's certainly not the law of this circuit.
No, but
it may not be the law of anything.
Right. But we
so,
believe
I mean, that can't be the heart of your argument any more than if they had gone the other way, you would argue it.
It's indicative of the way the courts will treat this as a binding regulation.
One case in one district court is indicative?
It's early yet, Your Honor. It's only been one year with the rule.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Heather Phillips, and I am here on behalf of the Department of Labor. At its core, this case is really about two key issues, and for both, OSHA has the better argument. First, was notice and comment required for the minor clarifying changes to an interpretive statement? And second, was that interpretation of law correct? On the first issue, there does not seem to be any real dispute that HAZCOM's paragraph A2 does nothing more than present OSHA's views on the preemptive scope of the HAZCOM standard in light of the statutory provisions of the OSHA Act.
It's a different view, though, right? I mean the language made some difference, right? To go from legal requirements to, you know, regulatory and legislative actions, there's a difference going on here, isn't there?
There are different words, Your Honor, but there is not a different view. And, in fact, we know that by looking at the legislative history.
Can you remind me, what's the purpose of the different words if it's not a different view?
To clarify any confusion that existed out among the public. And we know that by looking back through the legislative history of the rulemaking.
We know what? From
we know that there has not been a change in the interpretation. It's not a different interpretation. So the same interpretation has been in effect since 1983 when OSHA first promulgated the rule.
Didn't the parties comment on this during the course of the rulemaking?
Two commenters requested that OSHA state in the paragraph A2 that the HAZCOM standard was intended to preempt common law.
Two out of how many?
I'm not sure how many, Your Honor.
I think your opponent's sense was that the fact that there were two was actually cut the other way against you, that it was just a surprise that the final result of this was a surprise to everyone because no one was on notice that was possibly an issue here.
I thought your argument in response to that was that this position was so consistent for so many years, no one was surprised in the least.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
I was surprised that there were two people that actually thought that there was some question.
That is correct. Given the great weight of the case law that had gone the other way, I think it's difficult to argue that anyone out there actually thought that the prior version of paragraph A2 meant that the HAZCOM standard preempted common law. And as Your Honor points out, OSHA wanted to make it crystal clear that that was not the case and tinkered with the language, made some minor revisions to inform the public, also let the public know in the preamble that was the case, that it was not intended to preempt common law. And again, if you go back through the rulemaking, there are many indications that this has been the consistent position of the agency throughout the 30 years that the HAZCOM standard has been in effect. Back in 1983, there's a sole mention of tort law, and it's just to note that although it represents one form of redress, it's insufficient on the whole to ensure adequate hazard communication. You look at the purpose for enacting the standard back in 1983, it was to address the recent proliferation of state and local right-to-know laws. They actually calculated the costs, the reduced costs for not having to comply with those state and local right-to-know laws, but again, nothing about tort law.
So if this issue comes up in the context of a tort suit and your interpretation, let's call it that, as set forth in this language is put in issue, what degree of deference would you claim for it? Would you claim that it was entitled to Chevron deference, or would you claim that it was entitled to something else?
There are two issues with respect to deference going on in this case, Your Honor. Of course, there's the deference that, and I'd like to point out, of course, that we don't need to win on, we don't need deference to win our case. But with respect to deference, we should be afforded some deference with respect to our interpretation of the rulemaking, of the
right. No, I'm not talking. I'm not talking about your interpretation of your own rule. I'm saying that, as I understand your position, your interpretation as set forth in A2 is that this is the preemptive effect that you think the statute has. And my question is, what degree of deference are you owed on the question of the extent to which the statute preempts?
When this comes up in court.
Correct. Well, Your Honor, in Wyeth v. Levine, the court there noted that with respect to our opinion, they didn't respect with OSHA's opinion, of course, is the FDA, on the preemptive effect of a statute, we don't have any special authority to announce on that. But Wyeth did note that our position with respect to whether state tort law would present an obstacle to the accomplishment of our objectives, that should be given some weight.
So that you're talking Skidmore?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, this is consistent. I would be shocked if you had said Chevron. My colleague was setting you up.
Fortunately.
You were delaying a long time. Why is she hesitating?
Dodge that bullet. Shoot. All right.
You warmed up too long.
Skidmore. Yes, Your Honor.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Again, sorry, just to continue with the legislative rulemaking, in 1987, which is where the language that AFTRA points to now was introduced, it was made crystal clear in the preamble there that that language not was directed at the proliferation of local right-to-know laws. OSHA was concerned that courts were not interpreting the provision to cover those, so it added this language about requirements of any state or local agency. Again, no reference to tort law. Then in 1994, in the preamble, OSHA talks about product liability concerns and notes they're separate and apart from any regulatory requirements. They're irrelevant to the rulemaking. If producers want to provide additional data to satisfy product liability concerns, that's their prerogative. And then finally, in 2012, we have the discussion here of what the paragraph A2 is intended to cover. And again, the interpretation has remained the same throughout. And as we mentioned in our brief, that interpretation is also consistent with other statements that OSHA has made on the preemptive effect of standards. ATRA points to one letter that we cite, which is on the respirator standard. That particular letter withdrew a prior interpretation, but we would like to note that both letters are entirely consistent with our position, and that is that absent actual conflict, a standard will not preempt state tort law.
Can I ask you a question about ripeness, which is that if we were to take the view that this is an interpretive pronouncement, then you've set forth in your brief that you think that this is to a large extent unripe. I think that's the words you use. What is the small extent to which it is ripe, under your view, if there is such a small extent?
Arguably, I think it's not ripe, but arguably the interpretation itself is so intertwined with the notice and comment argument. ATRA is challenging our interpretation, and our interpretation is that the OSH Act, there's no express preemption of tort law, there's no implied preemption. However, the normal workings of preemption law, there will be conflict preemption. That is our interpretation, and I think to a certain extent the court could condone that interpretation. But with respect to the actual contours of any conflict, that is unripe, and that would need to be worked out in an actual specific tort case. Is there an actual conflict with the requirements of the HAZCOM standard or not?
So I'm not completely sure I follow, but it sounded like you started off by saying that you actually think it's entirely unripe. Am I misunderstanding?
Any pronouncement on a conflict is unripe, yes. Whether our interpretation of the OSH Act, as we set forth in paragraph A2, that again, there's no express preemption, there's no implied preemption, simply conflict preemption if it exists. I mean, the very bare bones of that interpretation. The court conceivably could pronounce on that.
Without any answer as to conflict preemption?
Correct. Right. Any answer at this point is purely speculative.
Okay. What should we make of the form in which it appears, that it appears in the Federal Register? Your opponent has tried to make a great deal of that. What should we...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. What would you make of... I didn't
the fact that this appears in the Federal Register.
Well, I would note that that's not an uncommon...
I'm sorry, in the CFR. Yeah.
The CFR. Not uncommon for agencies to discuss preemption. The President's executive order in 2009 actually addresses this and requests that agencies go back and look at preemptive statements and preambles, so it's absolutely not uncommon to put interpretive statements there. I would also note that under 5 U.S.C. 552A1D, agencies are actually required to published in the Federal Register general interpretations of general applicability. So I think there's no moment in the fact that this is...
Well, I posed a question to your opposing counsel that made it sound as if the appearance in CFR would be no different than appearance in a brief that would happen somewhere, that if you all got involved in a state court action and weighed in as an amicus, that it would be of the same value. Is that right? Is that...
I think that sounds right, and then, Your Honor, again, the state court should be looking at the actual language used in the paragraph A2, and there's nothing binding there. It imposes no rights or obligations. Anything substantive is derived from the remainder of the HAZCOM standard, so there is nothing binding on the state court in that paragraph
A2. I think the National Park Hospitality Supreme Court had a similar situation where there was a CFR report and regulation, and the court nonetheless said it's a policy statement. Not going to consider it. I mean, the mere fact that it appeared in the CFR didn't make it any less a policy statement, which was not reviewed.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, if you look at the language here, there's simply no indication that it's intended to, or that it has the ability to impose any rights or obligations, unlike the remainder of the HAZCOM standard. So turning to the second issue, OSHA's interpretation
What's the purpose of it then? I mean, OSHA can't bring an enforcement action under this. What's the purpose for this?
Of paragraph A2?
Yeah.
Well, looking back in 1983, when the provision was enacted, it was to make clear to the public what the HAZCOM standard was intended to address in case there were doubts. I think that's usually why such provisions are enacted, and throughout the rulemaking it's been reiterated that that's the purpose, to inform the public of how the OSHA intends the standard to operate.
So your argument is no binding legal effect, it's just a notice to the public?
Correct.
Of what you think the law is?
Yes. To inform the regulated public how OSHA will be applying the standard. I'm about out of time, but turning quickly to our interpretation, again, it's our position there's no express preemption. We know that from GADE. The preemptive effect is derived from Section 18B of the standard. We'd like to emphasize here, it was not emphasized as much in our brief, but it's not only GADE that supports our position, but also Guyer and the Supreme Court's decision in Williamson following that. Reading that Supreme Court case law, we know that the savings clause here is going to save any common law tort actions.
I notice your time is up. I think
yes.
We have your argument. We'll hear from counsel for the union now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The unions believe this case is not right. There's no final agency action. It's not only the Supreme Court's decision in the hospitality case, but that's been the law in this circuit for quite some time. An agency statement of policy, like the legal interpretation that's at issue here, is just not reviewable. And to respond to Judge Griffin's question, does it matter that this interpretation is contained in a substantive regulation? The answer most recently, I think, was provided in the case that ASHRAE relies on principally, which is the Fertilizer Institute case. In that case, a key question was, what does the word release mean in CERCLA? And the agency, without notice and comment, in the final rule, opined on that issue. And there were complaints that the agency was obligated to undergo notice and comment in order to make that change. And this court flatly rejected that argument, 935 F second. And I can't read the jump page because I don't have my glasses. But it's there somewhere. It's the first part of the decision. And this goes back to the court's en banc decision, I think 30 years ago, in GM versus Ruckelshaus. That is, it is settled in this circuit, and now I think uniformly, that notice and comment is not required for an interpretive rule.
And when you start out by saying it's unreviewable, what category of pronouncements are you saying are unreviewable?
So I think there are two questions that have been raised before the court. First is notice and comment required? I think the answer to that question is no. That question is reviewable. The second question that is posited by ASHRAE is, has OSHA made the wrong determination in its legal opinions? That issue is unreviewable. It is a policy statement. It's very much like the legal opinion involved in the AT&T case, AT&T versus EEOC.
If we disagreed with you and went to the merits of that.
Well, I'd start with GADE, Your Honor. One of the things that's important about GADE, and this is at page 107 of the court's opinion, is the court there is adopting the Court of Appeals approach to deciding what's our laws of general applicability. And if you go back and look at the Court of Appeals opinion in GADE, and this is at 918 FSEP at 679 footnote 9, you'll see that the Court of Appeals flatly rejects the argument that there's any preemption of state common law or state criminal law, which was the key issue at the time. The worry was somehow that Section 18 would displace the ability of states to enforce their criminal law. And it was assumed by the Court of Appeals in footnote 9 that the savings clause preserved fully state common law tort cases.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Griever, you have 2 minutes to reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, on the rightness question, we think that the better government case of this court, the better government opinion, holds that this case here, our challenge, is right, both on the procedural point and on the substantive point. Both points are purely legal questions. Both points do not require the development of additional record in this case. These matters are right for this court's adjudication.
But if we disagreed with you about the effect that this is going to have, and you're relying on the New Jersey case, if we thought that maybe it'd be prudent to wait and see how others respond to this, then your rightness case goes away, right? The mere fact that there's your rightness argument goes away. The mere fact that we're dealing with the statute here, that's not enough.
It's not enough, but we're talking about the OSHA's interpretation of the statute, and it is a purely legal question. The question is whether or not their interpretation of Section 4, particularly in conjunction with Section 18, is proper. And we believe it's an improper interpretation.
Wouldn't we need to see how that's going to play out across the country before we decide that? I mean, you're relying on the New Jersey instance, but is that enough? Obviously, you think it is, but is that a problem that there's only been one case that's done this?
Your Honor, we don't think you need further empirical evidence to show whether the agency is right or wrong. You can tell by looking at the statute whether the agency is right or wrong. And we have the guidance of the Gate case to tell us that as well.
Can I ask you this? So suppose the New Jersey court did what you think it should have done, which is not to feel bound, but just to look at the interpretive pronouncement as an interpretive pronouncement and figure out to what extent it agrees with it under Skidmore deference. If every court did that, would you think that this dispute is ripe? So there's no binding effect. The courts treat it just as you think they should treat it.
I might not understand your question properly, Your Honor. I think the New Jersey court did say they believed that this is binding once it became law.
Right, and my question is, suppose that the New Jersey court and every other court treated this pronouncement in the way that you think it should be treated, which is not binding, but setting forth an agency interpretation that has to be reviewed under Skidmore to see whether it's right. So it doesn't have any binding force of its own effect. The question is just whether a court in a subsequent tort action is going to agree with the agency's interpretation of the preemptive force. If that's all that the agency's interpretation does, then is this right?
We think it is because it's in a rule. If it were in just an opinion letter in a particular case, it may or may not be. But in this case, by elevating it into a rule, we think it's made it right for review. There must be some reason why the agency went from the letter to the rule. They had already issued a letter on this very subject. Apparently that didn't work in the case in New Jersey to change the court's opinion.
So what if in the rule, and I'm sorry to belabor the point, but what if in what you're calling the rule, all they did was quote the letter, and they just said, for future reference, here's our letter. We issued it a few months ago. This sets forth our interpretation of the preemptive force of the statute. All we're doing now is just making sure that everybody sees it. We're putting in the CFR. The letter might not be otherwise publicly known, and that's all we're doing. Would you consider then that it to be right purely because they copied it and put it in the CFR?
Yes, we would, primarily because it's a wrong interpretation. And Syncor and the American Hospital case have both held that if the agency is wrong in interpreting the statute, it becomes right for review, and it's justiciable for review.
Okay.
When you say better government, are you talking about the FOIA case?
Yes, sir.
Where there was an application of FOIA underscored by a general rule, and we said it wasn't moot because the party had standing, it was going to be effective in later cases, and they had a right to challenge the underlying rule?
That's correct, Your Honor.
A very different situation. It was an as-applied rule, as I recall. I should recall I wrote it.
Understood, Your Honor.
That's a very different case.
Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.